Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Lynn and Bruce. You have Lynn Johnson here, and you have Bruce Rawls up in Castle Rock, Colorado. So he's just up the road from me for not even 100 miles away. But we're both here together this morning on ACIM Gather. So good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Lynn and all.
And Bruce has just posted for me what we're going to look at today, and I will
just a serving suggestion.
Just a serving suggestion. And, you know, I had a thought, too, because I think we're getting close to the end of these, aren't we?
There's about 100 more of them, and we can always loop back around. I'm probably going to start rereading them again once I get to the end. There's 1,300 plus. I forget how many exactly, but over 1,300. And we're about halfway through the 1,200, so.
1241 we're at. So I'm going to post the link in the room. People want to follow along. And what I was thinking was something I'd like to maybe do sometime, and just a thought, is since we're going through these lessons right now that have these topics of special relevance in them, I was thinking it might be good for us to go through the topics of special relevance at some point, and you know, each one of those is about as long as one of these Q&As, and really looking at, you know, what is sin? What is the world? What is, you know, what is forgiveness? What am I? You know,
right.
These are really great.
The 14 what is at the end of
the 14 what is it?
Yeah.
Or
is,
yeah.
I've actually been doing that with several other people with, you know, regular conversations. C.A. Brooks, for example, has been going through those, and Susan Dugan, and their audio and video, respectively, conversations. We've been going through quite a lot of those, but they're always worth going through again, and because they're just really great prefaces to the smaller workbook lessons that follow. In fact, they're actually recommended to reread each time you do any of those related workbook lessons, because it all ties together. And reading any of them, of course, is going to most importantly be a reminder to be in that mindful state of remembering that we have a choice between two thought systems, and always we can choose against the one that doesn't work for us, which is
exactly
what we're here for, right?
Well, yes, oh gosh, I just turned my volume up over there. I hear an echo now. Maybe it'll calm down. Yes,
it is.
Okay. The thing that's so good about those is that it gives you a frame of reference for mm-hmm. your lesson every day, mm-hmm. so that as you're doing the lesson, you really, you know what it is that you're looking for. Kind of the results you're hoping to find are what these things are telling us. So, for instance, what is, you know, the one of, you know, what is the world, and what, you know, these things are just really helpful as a context to follow
the lessons,
which is why Jesus gave them to us.
Yep, yep. they're very, very helpful, and they also work well with the clarification of terms and anything we might want to do regard.
The teacher's manual, the clarification. There's so much. This course is so full of wealth, and it's interesting to me. And I'm not going to make a political statement here or anything, but with all the stuff and wealth that's in these in the actual course, the supplemental pamphlets, the manual for teachers, all these different things. It's a wonder anybody wants to look and try to find anything else. You know, as far as like, let me dig through the urtext and let me see if I can find some special surprise that Jesus put somewhere for me. And, you know, everybody, what they're doing, I think, is looking for, you know, where's the trick? Where's the magic? Mm-hmm. You know, where's the thing that's going to flip this thought? Where's this thing that's going to make me, you know, suddenly, you know, get it and be awake? And, you know, they're always thinking there's some sort of secret, you know, passage that's, you know, he put
word.
Go ahead.
We're always looking for that. And I'll tell you what works for me is when one of our cats walks across the bed at 4:45, That gets me awake.
Well, Jesus should have put a cat in the Course of Miracles. And
actually, this morning it wasn't that. I just happened to wake up, and I've been up for a couple of hours working on various projects and having fun. But yeah, I think we think that there's some, like you say, magic, set of something external. And of course, as the Course is, reminding us, it's the form of the books, which our beloved Foundation for Inner Peace and Foundation for A Course in Miracles, have been incredibly prolific and generous in what they've been offering to us all these years. They have helped with the form of the reminders with, in terms of the books and then all the classes and workshops that Ken Wapnick has done and ongoing, respectively. But we have to remember that, within that wonderful teaching is the reminder that the form isn't it. I mean, and I think that one of the most graphic examples of that is the story about, Bill Thetford, how there was, I'm probably paraphrasing this and probably not even sharing it quite accurately, but it's something to the effect that there's a couple of Course students in one of his study groups, that were arguing over what one of the passages in the Course meant. And he just took the book and ripped the page out of it and crumpled it up and says, if this comes between you and your brother, it's not worth it, which is to say that, the form isn't the important thing. I mean, you can use the books as a stepladder if you need to reach something in a high cupboard, It's not like there's anything sacred about the form. It's the meaning behind the form. And I think that's why those early workbook lessons are such great reminders is, I've given all the meaning to everything that I see and we can make magical meanings and specialness, out of anything. But the whole goal, of course, is to become truly free and truly peaceful and joyous by recognizing the innocence that we never left, and the oneness that we never left, by forgiving, ourselves for having believed that was even possible.
Exactly. So. Exactly. Yeah. And I love that example of Bill Thetford.
Me too.
That's happened more than once. I think that happened actually. Maybe he didn't actually tear the page out, but I've heard it in so many different variations of that same story. It seems to me that it probably did.
Maybe he talked about doing that. I think that might have been what happened, but it doesn't matter. It was just really the thought behind it again, right?
Exactly. It's the thought behind it. And for me, the example then was, which brother am I willing to throw out of heaven because I don't like his interpretation of the book?
Which could tie into the current political situation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just as an offhand, irrelevant example to what's happening next Tuesday in this country, just for example, yeah.
Absolutely, and boy, have we seen it, and I've seen it not just, I mean, I've done been doing it my own self, I've been doing it my own self, but, what I've been doing is looking at when people are being particularly bullying each other, and the irony. I think that everyone was talking about the speech that Melania Trump gave the other day, and I don't know if you're aware of this or you're privy to all these political things. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I've kind of been busy enough that I have, other than the Daily Show and Stephen Colbert, my backup news, which to me gives me a little dose of humor, and just get the a few of the highlights in the news that were worthy of satirization. That's sort of my backup position when I'm really busy, which has been the case for this past month.
Well, you're going to hear about this one plenty, sure. because what happened is, this whole time that he's been pressuring his wife, who's from Slovenia, to
And there's a Slovenian translation, by the way, of course.
Yes, 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 there is.
Just a quick plug for the Foundation for Inner Peace. And there's a new Estonian version that's come out, too.
I saw a new Estonian. That's so cool. Yeah. As new versions of A Course in Miracles in other languages. They've been pressuring for her to give a speech. So she did. She gave a speech a couple of days ago. Uh-huh. And she talked about what her platform as a first lady would be. And her platform as a first lady is she wants to get rid of all the meanness and unkindness in the cyber world. She wants to stop cyberbullying. And she says the worst thing is the cyberbully. And the thing that's so ironic about that is that her husband is the biggest cyber bully on the planet. You know, I mean,
one would imagine anyway. there is a fair amount of irony in that. Yes,
it's hugely ironic, and people were wondering, you know, did somebody write this speech for her as a trick? You know, is somebody just really wanting to make her look stupid? You know, like she doesn't know that her husband's the one who's been tweeting all this nasty garbage about people all right and left. Uh-huh. And it's ironic. And so you're going to hear a lot about it because it's just so silly. But, you know, and I felt bad for her because either she doesn't understand what cyberbullying is or she doesn't understand I just think that maybe perhaps – you know, I hate to say because she's not from this country that she doesn't understand this stuff because that's really very racist. However, I think she doesn't understand that. The whole idea.
Well, perhaps on some level we all understand, but. The best part of it is that nothing happened. Now, on the level of form, we certainly wouldn't want to condone, you know, cruel behavior or anything that, you know, resembles that, or ignorance of same. And yet at the same time, if we can look past that and realize that we've all chosen our scripts in order to give us the opportunity to look at our projections and to see that she's projecting, her spouse is projecting, everyone in this country that has judgments about those two people or any other political figures or other candidates, let alone, you know, the rest of the 7+ billion of us, I think approaching 8, something like that, plus billion. Well, eight soon, I guess. Those are all projections that can be part of our classroom for forgiving our decision to have, you know, the en masse decision that we all made as one, you know, one fragment from the whole, seemingly, to, you know, believe that separation was possible. So that's really an incredibly helpful classroom that whenever we have the least little twinge, let alone outright outrage for what we see on our TVs or laptops or, you know, desktops, phones, whatever media we're consuming, is really just a feedback mechanism for the contents of our unconscious mind, and that the nature of the projection is that, you know, we get to look at what we haven't healed within our own minds, and that what a gift that is. I mean, that really is a gift. It doesn't mean that we necessarily vote any different at the polls, or that we, you know, when we're talking to other people, you know, don't recommend candidates that we think would be harmful for the welfare of not only the country but the planet as a whole. But it just means it's like we can simultaneously, you know, chewing gum and walking at the same time, you know, look at the contents of our mind and say, oh, how am I feeling? What are the thoughts that are going through in my mind, and what is this contributing to my well-being and my peace, as well as everyone else's at any given moment? And that, to me, is really at the heart of, you know, the opportunity that we have to look at what's going on in the world politically or in any other capacity, and see that you know, we do have an opportunity to choose once again I could see peace instead of this, and that I'm never upset for the reason I think. I mean, it's really that simple, isn't it? Are you still there, Lynn? Hello, Lynn. Did we lose our connection?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just heard a long pause there.
So, absolutely. That's exactly what happens, is that, as long as I believe I'm the character, as long as I believe that you're the character, then I'm going to be offended by you, right. And you're going to be offended by me. You right. can't help but be offended by something that is really made to attack you. So let's get over that stuff and move on to seeing our brothers as the Christ, which is, of course, our goal, mm-hmm. or at least it's my goal. And stop talking to the character. Stop being involved with the ego. And just be Christ to Christ with your brothers. And let's leave our battles on the floor and go have some milk and cookies.
Yeah, and I think it doesn't, again, of course, the A Course in Miracles is never about form or behavior, but always and only about the mind. So that basically is a reminder that do what you feel like you need to do on the level of form, either as an activist or as a concerned citizen or a responsible voter or, you know, whatever, a family member, a community member, a member of society. It shouldn't change anything there. I mean, that, if anything, it should enhance the relationships we have with everyone, because on that other level of the mind, we are remembering more and more frequently to see that everyone and everything is our classroom and our projection. Because it's our projection, we realize that I'm the guy in the projection booth, and I choose, the director's cut that's going through. I have this unique projector that I don't get to choose what's on the film, but I get to choose which director's cut I listen to. And that to me is hugely helpful, because that means that I can either see this as a script that is keeping me victimized by the current political process, or let's say the world's environmental conditions or socioeconomic factors, or, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be geopolitical. It can be just something like, you know, simple as something that your spouse or family member or coworker or people that you relate to frequently or occasionally do on a, you know, frequent or infrequent basis that you find annoying or irritating or that you wish, you know, someone else would change. All those things become the fodder for the classroom of, you know, going above the battleground, seeing that there's a new way of looking at things, you know, a real alternative. That really isn't new. It's just it's been all along, right? But we can become more peaceful by recognizing that A, it's not out there, it's in my mind, and B, there's no real cause for upset. That no matter what seems to be happening, there's a realm of peace in my mind that I can tap into and become aware of at any given moment. And that realm of peacefulness, the miracle instance, if you will, become more and more frequent as we practice becoming aware of that capacity that we have to go beyond victimhood and go beyond martyrdom and being at the mercy of, and instead be merciful to ourselves and everyone else. Because
exactly.
There's just one being here. There's no one else in the room.
And that being merciful, that being kind, you know, which, you know, whether Jesus actually said be kind or not doesn't really matter, does it? Because really that's all that's being said is your brother, excuse me, is really not responsible for his situation. You know, we're not responsible for our situation. We're not responsible for any of the scenarios that are going on in the world. The only thing we're responsible for, is who we choose to look at it with.
Right, right.
How we choose to see it. And, exactly. And you know, when I switch over and recognize that that's really all I'm doing is deciding to look at through things through the ego or the Holy Spirit, it makes it so very simple. Who do I love? Who do I trust? It's my brother who's one with me. That's all it can be. So no matter what our brother appears to be doing, he is always right. You know, that sounds crazy, but you know, we're all the same, and we're all trying hard. We're doing our best. So
we're all fighting the same hard battle, huh?
We're fighting the same hard battle. So let us, you know, let us love each other. So let's look at this question. I think it's going to be good. Number 1241.
Uh-huh.
I think you posted here. And yes. Would you mind reading while I blow my nose? Because I'm going to start.
Certainly.
Okay. I'm having a little bit of allergy, I think, this morning or something. So here we go. I'll turn the mic to you.
Okay. So what we're about to read is from the Frequently Asked Questions of FACIMOutreach.org, and we've been going through one of these a week for some time now. The one we're about to read is question number 1241, and you can get to those from FACIM.org and then click on the supplemental material links there, and a few clicks and you get there. Or you can just go to FACIMOutreach.org and then find the numerical chronological index, and then you'll get to 1241, which I'm about to read, which goes, I have struggled most of my life with never being fully aware of God's love for me. I understand and appreciate his love for others, just not me. Perhaps experiences from my childhood are the cause, or just a very poor sense of self-worth. The reasons could be endless. I see the problems and the errors in my thinking, but that does not provide an answer or healing. I feel abandoned by God. His love is just not quite within my reach. How do I heal this thought when I do not even see myself as worthy enough to be heard by God? When I read and study the Course, it feels as though my ego, my resistance is greater and stronger than God, and he is waiting for me to heal this perception of myself and of him first, and until then, he will just remain silent. Could this be true? Well, this opens up a lot of questions for all of us, because I think on some level, we think we threw God under the bus. We believe that we pulled this off. And before we start reading the answer, just a couple of commentaries. One is that we actually, because we think we threw, you know, God into the bus, we destroyed perfect oneness, we shattered the perfection of heaven. We have this an unimaginably negative opinion of ourselves, and that's the unconscious guilt that Course in Miracles continually asks us to look at, not because it's real, but because it's not real. But if we don't look at it, it's like, you know, having the tie downs on your airplane and the wheels chalked and trying to wonder and figuring out why you're not getting off the ground. You know, you gotta remove the tethers and the tie downs and the chalk blocks and the anchors and everything else that is holding us back. And the only way to do that is to look at them and then with help from our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit. And then having done that with that assistance, we see that there's nothing there. But it's only with that perspective above the battleground that we're going to do that. Another thing I think that comes to mind is that the perspective that we have as individuals, seeming individuals, is that, you know, God has no awareness of us. And you know, later on in the Course, and Ken Wapnick talks about this very eloquently, you know, he reminds us that God doesn't have any idea that there's separate individuals, that there's galaxies and planets with people on them, and certainly not of a Bruce or a Len or anybody else who happens to be listening to this. You know, that's sort of like totally irrelevant to the perfect oneness. And if it, the beauty, of course, is that if that were the case, you know, then it would be hopeless, but it's not. But because that perfect oneness hasn't been shattered, because it has no cognizance of the dream of separation, that remains steadfastly, pristinely, invulnerably, invincibly true, and that's our way out. That remembrance of that perfect oneness that we took with us into the dream, that is symbolized by the Holy Spirit or Jesus of the Course or inner kindness teacher or whatever label you want to put on it, gives us the breadcrumb out of the cave, or the string, or whatever, you know, whatever metaphor you like, to get back to the light, that helps us realize, okay, as individuals, as an individual in truth, there is the no seemingly separate self, but that's no different than saying, I've imagined myself as a drop in the ocean. But if you look at the ocean there, you know, if you're down in the water anyway, there are no separate drops. It's all one thing. But the illusion of a separate drop within the ocean is just a thing that we've gotten so fixated on that, you know, we've forgotten that we're really all the ocean. And the ocean is everything, and the self we think we are is nothing. So we need a gradual process that helps us gently and gradually let go of this idea of a separate self. And I think that's where the forgiveness classroom and seeing the shared interest and trusting Holy Spirit, you know, Gary Renard's teachings have, you know, this kind of the big three, the quantum forgiveness, the true prayer of just dropping the things we think we need, and then trusting in the Holy Spirit's interpretation. Those three are a wonderful combination for helping us through this process of believing that the nothing that we think we are is going to do it for us, and being terrified that letting go of that is going to be a problem. but that's again, you know, I think what this question addresses, and you want to start reading the answer this provide her, the first part?
Sure, sure. Okay. Just a couple of topics or comments here. One, the question, and of course the question is, I'm not aware of God's love. Mm-hmm. I don't experience God's love. You know, I'm just trying to figure out why, because I have a very poor sense of self-worth. I think that this is a common, it is common. Lesson 93 tells us all about it, and I think it's uh-huh. very true that we believe that even if we're the most arrogant person in the world, the only reason that we act in that arrogant way is because we have a lack of self-worth. And we, you know, I mean, it really is, you know, psychologically, there's a lot of reasons for that. But the real reason that I, as far as I can see, and you know, this is just my own perspective on things, is because if I believe that I actually do have the power to destroy heaven, kill God, strike out on my own, start a whole new universe, I have the power to do all these things, then it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying to think that I could actually do this to myself. And this is the reason that I'm so terrified, is because I think I have actually done this. And to be able to conceive of the power of the mind to actually, you know, build a universe to shut God out is, you know, overwhelming and guilty. I mean, I feel very guilty because of it. Because, you know, I know I don't, I've stolen, like in the, you remember that movie Time Bandits? Uh-huh. I've stolen the map. You know, I escaped from heaven and stole the map, and now I'm out in the, you know, causing ruckus everywhere. And, you know, I look at the ruckus I'm causing and it's horrifying. You know, I look at what's going on in recognizing my own responsibility, even not consciously recognizing my responsibility for it. Because if I consciously knew the my own responsibility for it, then it would end. I would, you know, if I consciously knew my own responsibility for the world appearing the way it does, then I would stop, because I would really recognize my own power. But this is it's not recognizing my power, and it's denying my power, denying what I am as the Son of God, and believing that somehow or the other, I deserve to be punished. I'm guilty. And so the entire fabric of the universe is that belief in guilt, sin and punishment, that, you know, somehow or the other, I've really screwed everything up. And you know, and, you know, locked God out at the same time. So no wonder, you know, I feel bad. My goodness. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So, but the questioner is asking these questions, let's see, that God, he's blaming God. He says, when I read and study the Course, it feels as though my ego, my resistance is greater and stronger than God, and he is waiting for me to heal this perception of myself and of him first, and until then, he will just remain silent. Could this be true? And I mean, talk about throwing God under the bus. You know, that really is, you know, like, oh, he's just watching me struggle here. Right. And he's just waiting for me to give up my struggles.
Right. There's sort of the implication in that the way it's phrased is that something is being withheld or abandoned, you know. And as the questioner states, you know, I feel abandoned by God. But that presupposes, again, that the impossible was possible.
Exactly.
How did the impossible occur again? It ties right into the heart of the metaphysics of the Course, doesn't it?
Right. And we don't have that power. You know, I mean, this is why understanding the metaphysics of the Course is so essential, because we do not have the power to do any of these things of which we accuse ourselves. Therefore, it has no reality. It couldn't possibly be real.
Right. We only have the belief in choice because we appear to be here and we appear to need the opportunity to choose the other thought system in order to restore our mind to the state we never left.
Right.
But we don't get that. You know, and that was one of the things that years ago, before I found, you know, the Course in terms of starting studying it anyway, that it was helpful to me in sort of an early metaphysical study of the Bible, and King James Version is what I was reading at the time, off and on. And in the Gospel of John, there was a phrase of the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not, or comprehendeth it not, or something like that. I forget exactly what the quote is, but something like that. And I thought, well, that's really kind of fits the the two thought systems, because the light is really the Holy Spirit's thought system that shines away the fear and the darkness of the belief in separation. But while we're identified with the seemingly separate self, it's a dark place and it's a scary place. But it's only scary in the sense that we're holding out our thumb at arm's length and blotting out the sun or the moon, you know, in our imagination. They're still there, you know, or clouds, you know, obscuring the celestial orbs, you know. It's like, they haven't gone away. We've just hidden them by our intention, and that intention is just the craziness of a silly dream that you know, that insanity has had no effect on reality.
Exactly.
You want to start in with the first paragraph?
Sure. Okay. So he's the answer says, resistance to changing our beliefs about ourselves is a major aspect of every student's spiritual progress or process, as is feeling unworthy of love. Kenneth's book, Ending Our Resistance to Love, speaks to these issues directly. As is discussed in this book, being aware of your resistance is extremely helpful. But what you want to add is a decision not to justify your feelings of unworthiness. Although sometimes it is helpful to delve into the past and to shed some light on this sense of unworthiness, the key to resolving the conflict is realizing that you are making a decision to hold on to that belief about yourself in the present.
Uh-huh.
It always comes down to this moment now. I am making this decision. This moment now, I am making this decision. It doesn't sound like Earl Purdy, but
I was just thinking that. I love what he did at the workshop in San Francisco about workbook lesson 50. You know, I don't know if you were there for that, but I particularly loved his meter and rhythm with you know, chanting the title of that workbook lesson 50.
Yeah, he is just amazing. Yeah. But really, but that's what you have to do. You have to remember this moment.
It's a rhythmic mantra. Why not? Go for it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you say, okay, so although sometimes it is helpful to delve into the past to shed some light on the sense of unworthiness, the key to resolving the conflict is realizing that you're making a decision to hold on to that belief about yourself in the present. That is what you want to focus on. The ego loves to bring in the past because the past cannot be changed, which means we all be tempted. I think are tempted.
Will be tempted is what it says.
Oh, well, we will be tempted. I missed the will. Okay. It means we will be tempted to treat present conditions as limitations or handicaps we can do nothing about. Score one for the ego. and so this is reiterating my helplessness.
Mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
Because I look on the past and the past can't be changed, and this reiterates my helplessness. However, the past, this is because you think, you believe that all of this actually happened,
mm-hmm.
but it never actually did.
Go ahead. I was just saying, we're not only dragging a dead horse, we're dragging a dead phantom horse from the past into the present and trying to ride it. And because our imaginations are so powerful, we actually are imagining we're riding this dead phantom horse around, but it doesn't get us anywhere. We never went anywhere. We never left from where we remain perfectly innocent and at peace in the arms of God, if you will, metaphorically. But that's not our experience. We think that we're having this, I'm a separate person with separate goals and ambitions and I'm out, you know, the rest of the world is out to get me kind of, you know, craziness, including, as we mentioned a few moments ago, you know, the current political situation. It doesn't matter what it is. It's anything that we think could compromise our peace becomes a candidate for looking at our mind and seeing what we're voting for 24/7, 365 in our mind, that we can then, elect to choose a different thought system, and that's pretty cool, and no one can take that vote away from us.
No, and this is the thing: people cling to their belief in the past because they think they're stuck with it. They think that, you know, this is my karma, or this is my, the fact is, it's not your anything. It never happens. So it doesn't belong to anything or anyone. Just like a dream, you know, a fantasy, nothing actually belongs to anything because it never really happened. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is why the understanding the metaphysics of this course is so essential, because if you truly understand that it was an idea that happened in an instant, that in that instant there was madness, we had ultimate creative power to make up any illusion we want, and in that instant every illusion that ever could be was happening, was made. That is set in stone. It's not going to move. It's not going to change. We're not going to continue to make more illusions. Every illusion that ever could be was already made. So all we're doing is walking through this hall of illusions, looking, and watching, hopefully, our minds while we're apparently having these experiences and recognizing the truth about ourselves and our brothers, the world, God. You know, this is all we're doing here. So if you understand that as the metaphysics of the course, and I don't know if you agree or not with what I just said, but a lot of people don't agree. A lot of people say, no, I can change the script. I can, you know, I can create a new future. You can't. No. As far as I know, as far as I can tell from what Jesus tells us in the course, it's done. It happened long ago and it's over. And all we're doing is reviewing it. So if you know that, if you understand that, and then you look at these happenings through that perspective that's above the battleground, you're not down there in wallowing around in it, making yourself a part of the victimhood, you're actually seeing that this is a dream, you made this up, and now you're dealing with these dream figures who are characters, egos that we made up mm-hmm. in the story. That's all. Dream figures. Bruce is a dream figure in the story. As much as I love you, Bruce, you're a dream figure in my story.
Well, that's, fortunately, that's my way out of misery as well as yours, because that recognition is really the awareness that we did take with us into the dream, that we can call Holy Spirit or Jesus or whatever label we want. But that awareness is what has the capacity to rise above the battleground of duality and to look with loving kindness on all the characters that are in the dream and realize that they are dream figures. They're just like little puppets and little animated figures in a very photorealistic movie that has three-dimensional and hyper-dimensional, actually, aspects to it. But all the dimensions, anything beyond dimension one, which is perfect oneness, is just a dream. It's just a crazy, made-up, insane, unhappy reverie that we think that we, you know, are powerless to change. But as you pointed out, Lynn, we can't change the dream because that's not our capacity. But we have the capacity to change our identity, and there we have a tremendous capacity, because that single choice that we can continue to make over and over again until it finally sticks consistently is the choice to see our identity as mind, and that's what can look above the battleground and see the folly of it, the gentle awareness that reflects in kindness to everyone we meet, because we realize that everyone we meet and everything that we encounter is an aspect of our projected mind that deserves and is worthy of the love that we never left. So,
exactly. And this is another important thing about this, is that now, when I observe my brother who seems to be acting insanely, I know that that's not really him. It's not really, it's a character in the script
mm-hmm.
with an insane role. So, you know, they've been given, you know, the teleprompter in the brain is telling them everything to say and do. That's part of their, you know, part of the character is that they act the way that they do. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they are in that terror of being out of control of their own being as well. They're in terror. So,
right.
If I know that it's all this is not real, that's not really you. You're not really doing that. You know, this is a character. You're not attacking me. I can't be attacked. You are incapable of attack. So, you know, blah, it's all a neutral playing field here. Then, you know, I can then have compassion for the person who appears to be in such distress.
Mm-hmm.
I can have compassion.
Including the self that we think we are, right?
Exactly, because that is what I'm seeing as a projection of my own thinking. So if I have compassion for that projection, I'm having compassion for my own thinking as well. And that is, I can forgive all of that. I can forgive all of that. It's such a beautiful gift, forgiveness is. I hear people complaining about, you know, well, I don't see any real miracles happening here. And if there's, you know, this was, that all these things would be happening, real miracles. This is a real miracle.
Mm-hmm.
This is the realest miracle there can be, because when I see you as you truly are, I can't blame you for anything. I can't be afraid of you for any reason. When I join you without fear, and this is how Jesus worked. That inner kindness teacher, Jesus worked by being unafraid. Jesus worked by being open to anything and everything. He did not block out any possibility because he was thinking through the Christ mind. And so he didn't look and see dead people. He didn't look and see sick people. He didn't look and see angry people. He didn't look and see, he was not looking at the characters at all.
I think it's important to comment here that when you refer to Jesus, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're referring to the Jesus of the Course, who metaphorically had a representation in form with the personage that we think of as the Yeshua of a couple thousand years ago that had appeared to have a form that did various things, and this whole, you know, the entire Christian religion and so many other offshoots have sprung as a result of that particular lifetime. But the teaching that you're referring to is really the awareness that preceded that personage and extends beyond that, and no more or less than all of us have that same capacity and awareness to do. And that's why, you know, even in that highly distorted, highly misquoted, highly modified body that we call the Bible, there's one of the quotes that came through fairly unscathed is, you know, you two shall do these things and greater, you know, and basically saying there's no difference. The only difference, as A Course in Miracles points out, the only difference is that he has become aware of this as his only curriculum. And that capacity just remains latent in us because we're still flipping and flopping and being equivocating and vacillating and doing all those flippy floppy things with our mind going back and forth between those two thought systems. And he recognized, you know, early on, for recent history of this planet and galaxy and so forth, that really wasn't an effective choice to choose against perfect oneness. Exactly. And that's where it kind of ties back into this FAQ.
Yes, thank you for that. Because, yeah, the Jesus I'm talking about, and seriously, I do not see a difference. Because I think that, first off, it was a character in the dream. There was really no Jesus. I hate to tell you this. There was really no Jesus. There was really no Pilate. There was really no John, Mark, any of the apostles. There's really no Bruce, and there's really no Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
The belief that these actual characters ever could possibly exist is, again, the belief that God is powerless, because, you know, we could have gone off and made real things or miscreated real things. And that, again, is impossible. It's impossible for us to miscreate anything real. Only illusions can be miscreated, or are miscreations. And so there was absolutely no real power that could have made this world, this whatever. But Jesus is a symbol in the dream, and it's a symbol, and even 2,000 years ago, is a symbol. There's no such thing as 2,000 years. There's no such thing as a year.
Or the world. The central thought the Course attempts to teach.
Exactly.
So that kind of covers all the bases, doesn't it? I mean,
that's everything, right?
Yeah.
So these are all, again, it's all an idea. Basically, it's a thought. And of course, you know, not coincidentally, even though, you know, we think that these things have been wildly distorted over the 2,000 years, there are still people like Mary Baker Eddy and Joel Goldsmith and, you know, a lot of other people who are able to read that miscreated story and come out with exactly the same knowing of the reality of the Christ mind. So, it doesn't matter where it comes from or how distorted it is. When your mind is clear, you see the truth. And so this is, you know, a part of the mind training of A Course in Miracles is to clear up your mind so that you can actually see the truth. So you're not being fooled by the illusion. So this is, you know, it comes from changing first off, and you can do it in any order, I guess. You know, Jesus prescribes this throughout the course, and since A Course in Miracles is my book, that my teaching that I've been, you know, whatever, hooked up with, Jesus tells us that we do this through joining with each other, from seeing the Christ in our brother, from having relationships with our brothers that are unconditionally loving, that are forgiving. For you know, he tells us to, you know, true charity is to look at our brother and see him as being farther along than how he appears to be. You know, looking at you and seeing that you are actually something beyond what your body portrays. This is really the work of A Course in Miracles. Mm-hmm. This is the really the change in mind, because once I can see that you are the Christ, as Jesus said, when I was a man, Jesus was a man who saw the Christ in everyone he saw, and so he remembered God. So you know, why am I feeling all this unworthiness? Is not because I'm not seeing the Christ in myself, because for me, and this is not for everyone, but I've seen this in myself, it is impossible for me to see my own goodness and still attack you.
Right, right.
So if I'm go ahead. What you're gonna say?
I was just gonna say that ties in very nicely to what you were just reminding me of Artin and Persa, Gary Renard's teachers, that suggested the exercise of seeing not just part of spirit, but all of spirit in everyone. And that really kind of stretches our mind to realize that even the least little infraction or withholding of love or withholding of esteem for anyone or anything in our world, basically, if we tell ourselves that there's something in this dream of a world that is inadequate or incomplete, you know, in terms of the truth that's behind it, then we're basically making that same assessment of ourselves. And so the self-esteem that we have, if it's limited by the esteem we have for others or other, you know, whether it's animal, mineral, vegetable, whatever, then we're basically putting a tourniquet on our feeling of peace. And as of course reminds us, you know, a peace of mind is not a little gift. So shall I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, okay. I'm just going to reaffirm here that, yes, if I attack you, I cannot feel guiltless.
Right.
I can't feel innocent if I'm attacking you.
Yeah.
So you got to come right to the place where where does this self-hatred come from?
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the my desire to attack my brother.
Right.
You know, I can never feel good about myself ever.
Same yeah. hallucination that we keep regurgitating, and that dead phantom horse that we keep trying to ride. Okay, I'll read the next paragraph. Approaching your sense of unworthiness is as a belief you are choosing in the present, even though you do not experience it that way, advances you to the next step of looking at it now from the perspective of purpose. If you are choosing that belief, it must be for a purpose, which means there is a payoff to it, something you want. Since it leaves you feeling completely separate from God and even hopeless, then the goal of continuing to believe in it is to maintain your existence as separate from God. But the guilt over that, unconscious of course, would necessitate projecting responsibility for it, resulting in the feeling that God has abandoned you. And then of course, you know, the manifest realm of the world, that we have countless examples that seem to be reinforcing that idea, that are really just, you know, further propaganda. And that kind of ties into another favorite idea I forget which workbook lesson is it, 161? One of those anyway, the inner and outer shield of oblivion, basically. That the mind of the ego, which is again this phantom dead horse that we keep trying to ride, made up the sin, guilt, fear, death realm, which is the inner shield, but and it thinks that there's something that we deserve to punish ourselves for, which is of course crazy and insane, and it's unconscious until we realize that it's unfounded by looking at it with the Holy Spirit. And then to make it even more seemingly impenetrable, we've made up a whole cosmos of space and time and matter and energy and all the bodies and forms and from quarks to quasars and, you know, the galaxies and everything in between, that then seems to just totally anchor the prison in place. But the light shines through the chinks in the ego's armor. Those outer and inner shields of oblivion may be foolproof, but they're not godproof, because we can change our mind. There's always that happily nagging awareness in our mind that says, well, there must be a better way. There must be another way of looking at this that does restore the feeling of worth to our minds, for not only for ourselves, but for everyone. And then we can come at it from either angle. It doesn't matter if, like this particular FAQ suggests that, you know, this person was saying that, you know, they can see the humility and the innocence and the perfection in anyone else except myself, their self, then, we can come at it from that perspective, or we can come from the opposite one where we're wonderful and everyone else is scum. Doesn't matter. In any case, if anyone is left out, we're basically buying into those shields of oblivion, the ego's propaganda, and we're saying, I'd rather be upset and right than be wrong and at peace. You know, wrong in terms of identifying with a identity that has no basis in truth. You want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. And this is, wow, what a good, I'm just looking at our the whole thing that's going on with these elections, and you know, I hate to bring that up, but you know, this.
Oh, come on, Manila. You love it, Lynn.
Well, because it's such a great example of what
it is.
You know, this whole I look at you know, everyone is not everyone, but you know, I'm just going to say that broadly. People are projecting so much guilt. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what amazes me, is all the guilt that's being projected onto Hillary, onto Donald, onto the advisors, onto the, it's all, it is just a huge guilt projection fest going on. And I don't think that, you know, there's anything that you or I or anybody else can do. In fact, I know there's nothing we can. Whoever is going to be elected has already been elected. That happened long ago in an instant when we had a tiny mad idea.
This is our ego's and Holy Spirit's absentee ballots for making up the world, right? The two different scripts, yeah.
Exactly. And you know, I mean, I don't think that there's, and even because I even thought about it, there's a possibility that, you know, we can all wake up on the day after the election and I could be in a universe where Donald Trump has been elected, and you could be in a universe where Hillary has been elected. I mean, that absolutely could happen, because both of those possibilities exist in that tiny mad idea of the dream. So, you know, all that possibility is here. You know, it just, you know, where I end up is wherever it's going to be the lessons that are again going to show me the very thing that I'm the projector of the dream. I'm the dreamer of the dream.
And, you know, I think we can all make the choice. We can all vote for the outcome where we elect our inner kindness teacher as our counsel. And that to me is really the only meaningful choice.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, but the thing that I'm seeing then, obviously, because I need to see it, is that how much we are projecting guilt and projecting and projecting and projecting guilt. And every time I mean, it just is blowing me away. If you see any of this stuff on Facebook, which is, You know, I mean, yesterday they came up with a thing that WikiLeaks was saying that Podesta was going to satanic, you know, baby eating parties or something. I mean, these are the kind of, I mean, this is the world's worst nightmare that's just being projected on these actually truly innocent beings. You know, I mean, Donald is no more responsible for his behavior than Hillary is.
Right.
Nobody's responsible for behaviors in this world. All behaviors are neutral. This is another part, another essential thing to know. There's no justification for guilt. There's no justification to project anything other than pure innocence onto any brother. None.
Mm-hmm.
And don't think, oh, because, you know, I need to, even though I'm a Course in Miracles student, I still have to make sure that, you know, the world is taken care of. That's total BS. I have no responsibility for this world.
Yeah, again, now, just as a reminder, we're talking about the level of mind that A Course in Miracles addresses. We're not talking about the level of form, right?
I'm going to change your middle name to Caveat.
Well, it's not a caveat. It's basically, reminding ourselves in terms of the level of confusion that the ego loves to throw in there, because someone hearing this out of context might think that what you're advocating, Lynn, is, oh, well, then I don't need to vote or brush my teeth or go to work or be nice to anybody. You know,
Bruce? If
it's
they decide
not about that,
to do that, that's in the script.
Of course.
So
we have examples in our election that appear to be doing that sort of thing. And like you say, there's nothing quote unquote wrong with that, because there's nothing good or bad that thinking makes it so, as Shakespeare said. However, it doesn't mean that if you have, if you feel inspired to behave in a certain way, that why not choose something that would reflect the kindness that's in your heart and mind, and do things that become a mechanism by which, you know, quote unquote others might see. But again, as you're pointing out again, there's nothing that is required for us to do in the course's curriculum in terms of behavior or form. So, and it's not about that. So I think that, again, that's such an important reminder that if we get involved in level confusion, then we're getting away from the metaphysics of the course. And what we've been talking about really is, you know, for faithful course students, is only and always about the mind. And I think that's the whole key reminder in all this conversation.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I'm saying, because honestly, it doesn't matter. You're still going to do what you're going to do. So, you know, it is how you look at it, how you perceive it. And I do believe, and I think there's evidence for it in the course, that like I was saying before, all possibilities are there in that script. It's not like, you know, the Son of God using its, you know, infinite imagination only imagined a little part of the script. Anything that could possibly happen if we were able to be separated from God is in that script. And so, the thing that is up to me is to decide not, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? Where am I going to go? You know, I'm not going to plan, because, you know, there's no purpose in planning. You know, I'm going to be there. I'm going to always be here no matter what. I'm always going to be here in this instant. I'm never going to be in the future, and I have never been in the past. Never. There's no possibility that I could have ever been anywhere but here and now. Mm-hmm. And so here and now is where I have the choice of how I look at what it is that's going on. And either I look at it with love, or I look at it with judgment. And those are the two things. And judgment only comes from fear. So if I'm in fear, if I think that there's a possibility something's going to go wrong, a possibility the wrong person's going to get elected, a possibility that there's going to be a war, a possibility that I'm going to stub my toe. If I'm, you know, if I'm living in that fear, I'm actually just looking, I'm just living in the future. I'm just projecting out into the future and not staying here where, in this holy instant, in this now, where everything is perfect. There is no confusion about, whether things are right or wrong. And why that's important is because the more I can stay, I can be still a moment and go home. You know, the more I can still my mind from projecting out all that guilt. And I do that by letting go of that guilt, not holding on to, like the first paragraph said here, I think, although sometimes it's helpful to delve into the past to shed some light on this sense of unworthiness, the key to resolving the conflict is realizing you are making a decision to hold on to that belief about yourself in the present.
Right.
So and Jesus in the Course keeps bringing us back to this present moment. What am I? This present moment, what is my brother? And in this present moment, I am none of the characters, nor are you. So I'm going to go on to the next paragraph. We're moving along here. Three paragraphs. And okay, so this is why Jesus emphasizes that feeling unworthy of God's love is not humility or virtuous in any sense, unlike the view of many other spiritual paths. And that is in workbook lesson 61. In lesson 93 says, light and peace and joy abide in me, which is the ironic one, points out that our negative feelings are so firmly fixed that it is difficult to help you see they are based on nothing. They are meaningless beliefs and feelings because they rest on the false assumption that we truly are separate from God and hopelessly sinful and unworthy as a result. As part of the correction, Jesus assures us, your sinlessness is guaranteed by God. Over and over, this must be repeated until it is accepted. You are what God created or what you made. One self is true. The other is not there. Try to experience the unity of your one self. And boy, this could come from any Advaita text. This could come from any guru. This mm-hmm. very thing. You are what God created or what you made. You're either that, and I, can I change what God made? Realizing that our negativity is rooted in nothing real is extremely helpful, as we then would not be fighting against something we think is real. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I keep coming back to, you know, the script was written long ago. We're just reviewing it.
Right.
I can't harm anybody in it. You can't harm anybody in it. I can't harm myself. Nothing can go wrong. The only thing that I need to know is that I'm not responsible for anything that's happening in the script. I'm responsible for how I see it.
Yep.
And you're not responsible for anything in this script. You're not guilty. You've done nothing wrong. And I can't blame you. I can't project guilt onto you because if I don't believe in the script, you know, it comes down to this. What do I believe is real? Do I believe that God is real, or do I believe that sin is real? Again, you know, if you get that firmly in you, and I love this, and I got it from actually Reverend Yolanda's song, Let Things Be Exactly As They Are, where she sings, you can't change God. And you can't change me. You know, when I recognized, oh my God, to even imagine that I could have changed what God made.
mm-hmm. That's the arrogance again, isn't it?
It's that arrogance.